Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me well?
I can hear you well, thank you.
Okay. I put on the video, but it's maybe not necessary.
I can see you very clearly.
Okay.
I'm trying to see the titles of the books on the shelves behind you, but they're not that clear.
You're not going to like them.
Yeah, the first thing I do, it's a very bad habit, the first thing I do is try and, if there's a bookshelf, I try to see what's on the shelf. So
I do the same, but it's a lot of, I'd say it's basically leftist propaganda, mostly.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have a bit of that myself, actually.
Okay, yeah. Really? What kind?
Well, practically anything written in the 20th century, but... yeah, I have about half a shelf of Marx and the Frankfurt School. I was just reshelving all my books, and so I found that recently. So yeah.
Okay. So as I was writing in my email, the first question is, what are the intellectual roots and references of the alt-right? I read that some people say it's Samuel Francis or James Burnham before that. But what would you say would be the most important intellectual roots and references?
Well, the term alt-right, I believe, was coined around 2008 by Paul Gottfried. He gave a lecture where he basically declared the paleoconservative movement dead. And I think in the same lecture, he also called for the creation of an alternative right. So I see the alternative right as primarily emerging from the paleocon movement in American political thought. And the paleoconservatives would be people like Samuel Francis and Joseph Sobran and Patrick Buchanan. Now, Richard Spencer was working for the American Conservative, which was founded by Patrick Buchanan and Taki and a couple other people, to be a kind of flagship for paleoconservatism. And paleoconservatism defined itself in contradistinction to neoconservatism, which they were trying to combat, right?
Yeah.
And the paleocon movement sort of got old. A lot of its leading figures died. It never really effectively institutionalized itself. It never effectively mobilized large donors. Of course, Patrick Buchanan has written many best-selling books and had a lot of media access. He was the main face of it, but he's getting old. The American conservatives sort of lost steam. Taki left, I believe, I can't remember when, but he did create Taki's magazine. Mm-hmm. Richard Spencer ended up editing Taki's magazine for a while.
Yeah.
Then he left Taki's magazine, and then he created Alt-Right, Alternative Right, in the beginning of 2010. And sometime after that, the fellow who was running Washington Summit Publishing and the National Policy Institute, Louis Andrews, died after a long battle with cancer. Mm-hmm. And so those organizations were handed over to Richard Spencer. And really, I see primarily a continuity between the paleoconservatives and the birth of the term alternative right. However, when the alternative right webzine was created, there was a fairly self-conscious attempt to bring in a lot of different thought currents under that very vague umbrella.
Yeah.
And so that included things that were certainly not considered, how to put it, they weren't necessarily welcome in paleocon circles, and that would include things like, well, neo-pagans and paleo-masculinity and white nationalism, things like that. And so under the that broad sort of umbrella, there were a lot of different thought currents sort of came together. I actually wrote something about this at, I think it was the Occidental Quarterly Online, just after the Alternative Right webzine launched. So if you want to cite that or quote that, that's there. It's out there in the web somewhere. And After a couple of years, Spencer, I believe, sort of lost interest in editing Alternative Right, and other people took it over, really, on day-to-day functioning. And then he shut it down and launched his Radix publication. And I thought that was, in some ways, a good idea because he felt like he had lost control of the brand. But on the other hand, already at the time, Alternative Right was becoming a generic term. And if you invent something like, if you have a product that becomes synonymous with a whole genre, like Xerox or a Walkman or something like that, the last thing you do is throw away such a valuable brand. Yeah. But he did. He walked away from the brand. And Colin Liddell and Andy Nowicki have kept that alive. And then a few years, in the last 2 years, of course, the brand has become much more mainstreamed. Because of its vagueness, a lot of figures that are, again, sort of closer to the mainstream of conservatism than I am. I would define myself as a white nationalist and as a new rightist, not as alternative rightist, although I would use that term because it's a broad enough umbrella to encompass me.
But more specifically, white nationalist.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't feel the need to use sort of vague, broad umbrella terms, but other people do just because of their, because they're not comfortable with being more specific. And I'm all for people being as explicit and involved as they want to be and just respecting those decisions. So people like Milo Yiannopoulos, Mike Cernovich, Vox Day, all of them fairly prominent, connected with sort of the edgier reaches of the mainstream right, have started using that term as well. Also, people like Andrew, I'm blanking at his name, this is embarrassing, the fellow who edits the Daily Stormer, Andrew Anglin. Andrew Anglin, of course. As soon as the term got popular, he started branding himself as alternative right, and that was just sort of a douchey move on his part, a kind of trollish thing, to just try and take advantage of the popularity of the term, and I don't blame him in the least for that. So. Anyway, it is a very broad umbrella term, but the main intellectual root of it comes out of the paleoconservative movement. Now, as to what defines it today, I think the real core, the heart of it, the energy of it, really is white nationalists, new rightists, people like that.
I have that feeling also from reading a lot of what Richard Spencer writes. For me, it's, I think, white nationalists and sort of an identitarian.
Yeah, yeah.
But
European identitarianism, that's another term that we borrowed from Europe. Yeah. It's a good term. It's analogous to libertarianism. It states what's most important in your ideology, which is the preservation of your distinct racial and cultural and historical identity. So it's a good term. And that really is, I think, the where all the real energy is.
Yeah.
And that is what's generating a lot of the intellectual excitement, if you will, on the right, from the creation of memes and trolling and arguments, and in the past year and a half or 2 years, things that have come out of our sphere have actually started to shape mainstream political discourse within the Republican Party, for instance. I think it was in 2012, Gregory Hood at Countercurrents referred to mainstream conservatives as cuckold conservatives. And that was really the inception of the cuckservative meme, which, when it became more widespread through Twitter, became a really effective barb that drove a lot of mainstream conservatives wild because it was so true. And so we started shaping the discourse, and I think that's very valuable. Now, another current of thought that is sort of flowing into the alternative right that's very important is the sort of breakdown of the libertarian movement. And this is very important. I used to be a libertarian years ago, and I sort of followed this intellectual journey a long time ago. But in 2008, when the Ron Paul movement was getting started, I started noticing how overwhelmingly white Ron Paul supporters were. And it was an implicitly white thing. They weren't aware of the fact that this was a very white form of politics. It made sense more to white people than any other group. And I was sort of betting at the time that a lot of these people would start breaking away from this and moving in the direction of white identity politics. And when I was the editor of the Occidental Quarterly near the end of that time, I actually set in motion a essay contest on libertarianism and white racial nationalism. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of that was really to get our best minds to sort of think about this idea and create an analysis and work towards creating talking points that we could use to sort of ease the way of a lot of people towards our position. And that, I didn't think at the time, I don't think that bore any fruit really at the time. At least I didn't see any. But a few years later, after the 2012 election campaign and the end of the Ron Paul movement, basically, within the libertarian sphere, there was a real push by cultural leftists to basically just take it all over and to eject anything that seemed conservative or patriotic or whatever. It became this leftist globalizing and really sometimes quite explicitly Jewish takeover. And what happened is a lot of people were pushed out by just revulsion after, you know, there were these intense discussion groups online where people would be battling one another about this. And a lot of people just, you know, left in disgust. And one of those online groups, a Facebook group, actually became the source of the Right Stuff, the rightstuff.biz, which now has the Daily Shoa as their flagship podcast and so forth. Yeah. Those people are all ex-libertarians, and they have moved out of libertarianism towards white identity politics in basically the same way that I did and that a lot of other people have. And so that really is a broad tributary that is flowing into white identity politics and into the overall alt-right umbrella. And it's a very vital force too. Most of the people involved in this are quite young. Mm-hmm. Most of them are quite educated. It's very, very interesting. I had a dinner recently with some new young people who have come into it in the past 6 months to 2 years, and then some people who have been around for decades in it. And the contrast could not have been more marked because really the people who had been in this for decades were all kind of misfits, you know. They were socially awkward and weird people, and the younger crowd coming in were mostly quite impressive, sort of fratty, preppy, squared away people. Many of them with recent military careers, most of them in their 20s or around 30, and just a very different look and feel to this. People with a lot of agency and discipline and organization. Now, there are a lot of people that we call autistes who are, you know, if not outright autistic, at least on that spectrum, they're kind of socially awkward, and yet they do perform valuable functions. They're great meme creators and number crunchers. But there's also a large group of people coming into this who are just, they're very normal in their presentation, in their background. They're the kind of people who psychologically would not be inclined to get involved in any kind of radical identity politics. But there's a wind in our sails now. And they feel not only conviction, but they also feel like this is something that they can put their effort into and it might actually bear fruit. So there's a great deal of excitement and intellectual vitality here. And this is very interesting also. One of the things that sort of is internal I guess, rift within the alt-right umbrella is, of course, the Jewish question. And I believe the term really was coined first by a Jewish writer, Paul Gottfried. The paleocons have always been kind of friendly with Jews, publishing them and associating with them in their conferences and things like that. And yet within the white nationalist sphere, there's a strong group of people who are quite critical of Jewish power and influence in our societies. Mm-hmm. People like Milo Yiannopoulos and Mike Cernovich are Jewish to some extent mm-hmm. in their identity. It's kind of disputed in Cernovich's case because he put out his DNA profile and none of it came up as Ashkenazic or Jewish at all. But there were people who left Russia basically claiming to be Jews who weren't, so he might be descended from that kind of line. But anyway, that is a factor, definitely. There's a Jewish camp and a Jewish-friendly versus Jewish-critical camp split within the alternative right. One of the interesting things that I've now been hearing about is young Jews, like including young Orthodox Jews, which seems like a very unlikely category, are now being drawn into this. You know, they're reading Hartiste, they're sharing alt-right memes, they're outraged.
Yeah. I don't know Hartiste.
Oh, Chateau Hartiste. It's a blog run by this fellow who used to go by the name Royce. Now he goes by the name Hartiste.
Okay.
Autiste is a play on Hartiste. Oh. But anyway, it's a game blog. It's a blog about it's on a higher level than How to Pick Up Girls, but it deals with sort of realism in the relations between the sexes. And it's enormously popular, and he identifies himself as an alt-right figure. Uh-huh. And it's part of the manosphere, which is a sphere that overlaps with the alt-right. But anyway, we're finding these young Orthodox Jews who are now into Hartiste and into alt-right memes. And one of the things I think is going on here is they're just drawn to something that's intellectually vital and exciting. Mm-hmm. So this is something that I've been seeing signs of in recent months.
When you say there's a split on the Jewish questions, can you give me examples of those who are more friendly and those who are more critical?
Well, okay. I'm quite critical. Kevin MacDonald is certainly quite critical. The Occidental Observer is his flagship publication. He also edits the Occidental Quarterly now. So that would be one wing. And there is definitely a wing that calls itself alt-right, which is just basically rebranded National Socialism. And of course, they're quite Judeo-critical. The people who are more neutral or friendly on the Jewish question would be people like Jared Taylor, who runs American Renaissance, some of the people who were involved in the original alternative right are sort of neutral or friendly on the JQ, as we call it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, they're just outright Jewish figures who contribute to this, and that would include, you know, sort of the grand old man, the dean of it, I guess, would be Paul Gottfried now. And then beyond that, there's Milo and Cernovich. And so, and then within our camp, there are people who say, well, look, we can be white identitarians, but we can also, and they love to tweak this PC language, but we should seek, we should seek allies of color. Right. And so, you know, if they're Jewish allies, they would fall under that umbrella. One of the interesting things about this, and specifically the tributary coming out of libertarianism, is although libertarianism and the Ron Paul movement were overwhelmingly white, there were certain outliers who were, say, black Ron Paul people or Asian Ron Paul people or South Asian Ron Paul people. Mm-hmm. And in the battle after the sort of collapse of the Ron Paul movement after 2012, a number of these non-whites have sort of been swept along by the logic of it and also by their personal relationships into being involved as sort of allies of white nationalism.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're happy. Personally, I'm happy to have any allies I can get. And so, you know, I'm in an awkward position where some of the people who share the best memes with me and are showing up in my Facebook feed, well, you know, one's a black guy, and a couple of them are South Asians, South Asian Muslims, actually, which is even more awkward in some cases. But, you know, they put up with me and my remove kebab rhetoric, and we're all friends, and they have an intense moral and intellectual interest in this. So the broadness of the alternative right category really helps, I think, you know, it allows a lot of people to participate in this, but also the broadness of it is threatening to some people because, of course, in the end, this is not just ideas and fun on the internet. We really do have a vision of society. Personally, I would like to see racially and ethnically homogeneous societies emerge. And so what we have is a strange sort of moment in time where people in this multicultural context, some of whom are multicultural and multiracial, are coming together in a context or in a movement that is aiming at separation someday. Yeah. And I admire the people who are involved in this, and they're very, very principled. Some of them say, look, you know, I don't feel at home in a multicultural society either. I feel less at home than you do. I mean, this, you know, speaking of the United States or Canada, you guys created this society and you feel more at home here than I do. But nobody feels at home anymore in multicultural and multiracial societies. And so we're finding that we do have allies of color, because one of the dominant traits of what we're talking about, one of the main themes, ultimately boils down to alienation, right? Everybody should have a homeland. Everybody should have a room of their own where they can go and be themselves, a home of their own, and then logically a homeland of their own. It's nice to have a place where everything is familiar, where everything is intelligible, and where you don't feel that, you feel alienated, you feel a lot of stress and anxiety, and multicultural societies really are creating high-stress situations, low-trust situations, and the breakdown of community. So we're communitarians, if you will.
Yeah. And your idea of how did you call it? Racially, ethnically, what was the word you used?
Homogeneous.
Homogeneous. This would be for the United States, right? So it would be, so what do you do technically with the black citizens?
Well,
ideally.
Ideally. Well, ideally what I would like to do is, I mean, the landmass of the United States is quite large. And we do have to make some distinctions here. First of all, there are indigenous people, and certainly they have rights here, and I would not in any way expel them or remove the remaining indigenous peoples, but I would give them sort of maximum autonomy within their little ethnic reservations. And I think that's the only fair thing that can be done at this point. As for blacks, most of them came here involuntarily and descended from slaves. The fair thing to do would be to give them their own territories and their own autonomy, and, you know, basically separate that way. Now,
where, for example, where could they go?
Well, the South. There are large, heavily black states in the South, and a couple of those, they certainly have ample resources and ports and things like that. I mean, everything that somebody could need to have a thriving country. Some areas in the South might, some states in the South might be a good black homeland. Now, as for post-1965 immigration, that is really the main problem. Since 1965, America has gone from a country that was 90% European in descent to a country where, well, we don't even know anymore, mm-hmm. because the government has been maintaining that there are 11 million illegal aliens in this country for decades. We know that that number has changed. It's more like 30 million or more than that. So we honestly don't even know what percentage of our country is European descended, but it's approaching 60%. It's going down to 60%. And where there are statistics about children being enrolled in school, and there are large numbers of states where, among 6 and 7 year olds, we're the minority now, just a distinct minority. Most of that is due to immigration into the United States in the last 51 years. My view is the following. I wrote an essay called The Slow Cleanse, which sounds like a dieting thing, but it's about ethnic cleansing. Mm-hmm. And to use an ugly term, but basically I say, look, we shouldn't allow ourselves to be seduced by these apocalyptic scenarios about race war and cataclysm and things like that. We should recognize that the contemporary situation was created over a 50-year period, and it was created by instituting demographic trends that are not favorable to the European majority. Mm-hmm. We can fix it in the same way. We simply need to create positive trends for the European majority. So what would those trends be? Well, first of all, stopping immigration from mm-hmm. non-white countries. Second, sending back all the people who have come here illegally, that would be a good thing. Just make it impossible for them to draw welfare, hold down jobs, put their children in schools. Basically, take away all the incentives that led them to migrate here in the first place, mm-hmm. and then they will deport themselves. Beyond that, then there's a large population of people who are sometimes second and third generation now. They do have homelands. A lot of these people have close contacts with people overseas. We know that because they're constantly trying to bring more relatives over here. And Lord knows I'm all for keeping families together, and what we need to do is reverse that kind of chain immigration, family reunification tendency. Many, many people move in America all the time. We are a very rootless society. People have to move because they live in a city where there's a real estate bubble and their rents become too high for them to afford. And we just accept, oh, well, rents are going up because of speculators, right? You have to move. No one sheds a tear about that. People's jobs change. The factory they work on closes and is rebuilt somewhere in Mexico or Indonesia. We don't shed many tears about that kind of forced uprooting of people. My attitude is that we should not shed any tears about uprooting people for something far more important than just, you know, the whims of the market and the private interests of capitalists. We should basically have an attitude that, look, people move all the time. If there are, say, non-white families that work for large corporations that are global corporations, the next time they're relocated, we want them relocated overseas. Mm-hmm. If there are bright, at many, especially West Coast American universities, the majority of students are now Asian, right? I think that we should encourage those Asian students, many of whom are bi and trilingual and have fairly shallow roots in America, if any at all, we should encourage them to pursue higher education in Singapore or Japan or China. And if they do it there, they'll not come back. And basically, if you just start nudging things in those directions, we can wait 50 years. But one of the things that I constantly stress is that we would not have to wait 50 years before we could reap some of the psychological benefits of knowing that as a group, white Americans now have a future, because a lot of white Americans feel that as a group, they don't have a future. And I think this is part of the reason why the mortality of whites, especially working class whites, has gone way, way up, because a lot of people are, you know, they're hopeless. They see nothing but diminished prospects for themselves and their children. They turn to alcohol and drugs and risky behaviors and things like that. And this has been rather epidemic, especially in the last 4 to 8 years since the current economic depression set in. And I think that people, if they felt they had a future again in America, or the French, if they had a future as a people in France, today they would start feeling a lot more optimistic. Probably they would start new businesses, have babies, and so we reap a lot of psychological benefits today, even though it might take 50 years for us to get back to, say, status quo 1965. Mm-hmm. In terms of my ultimate goals, I love the idea of neat, homogeneous, partitioned homelands and things like that, but as a reasonable political goal that I would put forward, for even within the present political context, I'd say, let's return to status quo 1965. That was when American workers were doing the best, when America was sending a man to the moon, when our cities were clean and vibrant, in a good way, vibrant with commerce and culture, rather than, you know, Rastafarians and druggies and things like that, jungle music, whatever. And what we need is it would be perfectly reasonable to do that. The 1924 Immigration Act set ethnic quotas based on a certain base year. We could have a status quo 1965 principle. And if we got back there, I think we would be at a point where white Americans would probably feel so de-stressed and so happy about their future that they probably wouldn't even think that we would need to go all the way to separate homelands. I would want to, you know, in 2065, when I'm dead, I'd want the next generation of our movement to be moving the goalposts in that direction. But the fact of the matter is that it doesn't need to be some kind of cataclysm or apocalypse like a lot of sort of old right, and by old right I mean fascist and national socialist influenced people like William Pierce, for instance, envision.
Okay, thanks. And back to my initial question about the references. For what would you say would be the main thinkers of white nationalism, either contemporary or older political thought?
The main thinkers of contemporary white nationalism first. The people who are most read and commented on would be Kevin MacDonald, Jared Taylor. They're contemporary writers in their 60s and 70s, and they're very, very influential. William L. Pierce of the National Alliance is certainly a huge, enduring influence on white nationalism in the Anglophone world and outside it, for that matter. It's an ambiguous influence. There are many things I disagree with about him, as I indicated.
Pierce?
What's that?
William Pierce?
William Pierce, yeah. He's a very important figure. Samuel Francis had a great deal of influence on it. He never really defined himself as a white nationalist explicitly, but he participated in American Renaissance conferences and wrote many things that deal with race.
Yeah.
J. Philippe Rushton wrote on human biodiversity, racial differences in his book Race Evolution and Behavior, and many other other papers. He was certainly a major influence in white nationalism today.
Okay.
Probably the most canonical statements about racial differences for most white nationalists are Rushton's writings. I'm trying to think
and
of others.
That would be based on evolution. How do you say evolutionary biology?
Yes.
That kind of.
Yeah.
Okay. And could you sum up for me William Pierce? What does he bring to the...
Well, I mean, Pierce... Pierce is basically a neo-Nazi. He was early on a follower of the George Lincoln Rockwell's American Nazi Party. He joined that party after Rockwell was assassinated. He carried on one strand of that National Socialist vision in America. He ran, created the National Alliance and ran it until his death in 2002. It was a largest organization, certainly the largest organization in the United States of its type. They published books, magazines, held conferences, encouraged people in various forms of activism. His most influential book, unfortunately, is The Turner Diaries, which is a kind of revolutionary potboiler with a kind of race war apocalypse in it, which I think has, you know, it fascinates a lot of people, but I think that it also serves as an impediment to thinking about serious policies that one could actually actually put in place that most people would not just shriek and run away from. He was a somewhat contradictory figure because, on the one hand, he was an elitist. He was a PhD in physics. He had a stratospherically high IQ, although he tended to be sort of a have a kind of engineer's mentality. He was basically a kind of Leninist in his views about politics. He thought of himself as an Orthodox National Socialist, but he was pretty much a Leninist in his revolutionary attitudes. On the other hand, he was constantly taking shortcuts and compromising with what he himself called the buffoonery of populism, which led him to, for instance, buy a skinhead music label and recruit in the subculture of skinheads, which didn't work out well for him. So yeah, he, at his best, he's very, very good, and he really did influence me on a number of points. I remember in 2000, 2001, listening to his weekly radio broadcast where he would analyze primarily, you know, current events, and he would stress over and over again the relevance of basically the power of organized Jewish community in America in shaping events. And just hearing that repeated over and over again over a couple of years and seeing the relevance of it to the things I was following was very, very convincing to me. Before that, I'd read Kevin MacDonald's work, and intellectually it made a lot of sense. You know, he's dealing with psychoanalysis, the Frankfurt School, you know, deconstruction, intellectual trends like that. But to have Pierce bring it home to contemporary unfolding political events was very powerful for me, and it showed the relevance of that analysis. So that was, and really that's his greatest, I think, influence was his radio broadcast, that and the Turner Diaries. Of course, he's no longer commenting on current events, but the Turner Diaries is still being purchased and read. So,
when you say he's a neo-Nazi, is there an effort in the alt-right, or at least in the white nationalist branch, to have a filter from neo-Nazis? I mean, to ban them?
Well, yes and no. There are really three attitudes towards neo-Nazis. One is there are people who are neo-Nazis, and they think everybody else should think their way. Two, there are people who aren't neo-Nazis and want to engage with them somewhat constructively, because a lot of them are really young, they're naive, and they're highly idealistic people, and they can grow intellectually. And so what I've tried to do is I've tried to be somewhat constructive in my engagement, and to say, well, yes, I see the relevance of this, however, it's more complicated. It's not quite so simple as you thought, and basically historical reenactment of interwar fascism is not the answer. And then there's a third group of people who basically wants to create a cordon sanitaire around them and just keep them out completely. Those are the three tendencies within the alternative right.
Okay, and you're in the second category.
I think that unreconstructed National Socialism and fascism, interwar fascist movements, let's just call it that, are certainly not the way forward. These people were aware of a lot of truths, and I won't deny that. And I do think that something like fascism in a very generic sense is what every society ends up with if they try and do things like reconcile different class conflicts, interests of labor and capital, for instance, if they take their own side in international conflicts. I do think that a kind of organic idea of society is, you know, it's somewhat fascistic, and societies move in that direction, whether they want to call it social democracy or something else. They still move in that direction as they reconcile internal contradictions and as they try and educate people to be patriotic and so forth. So, but on the other hand, the thing that's worst about these ideologies is, to me, they're not realistic about how we're actually ruled. They emerged at a time when they were literally fighting communists in the streets, okay? And to beat Leninists, they adopted their tactics. They had to. You take a knife to a knife fight and a gun to a gun fight, and when you're fighting Leninists, you have paramilitary parties and militias and things like that. That's what they did, right? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, they adopted quite a few traits of communism, including some of its worst traits, and in the end, they didn't beat it. Today, we're not ruled in a hard Leninist fashion. The left controls us through soft power. We have, as Jonathan Bowden put it quite strikingly, we have something that between the wars would have seemed utterly impossible and paradoxical. We have a left-wing oligarchical society. Mm-hmm. We are ruled by an oligarchy, and yet all the reigning cultural values are leftist. Mm-hmm. Leftist values, especially leftist identity politics, are no threat to the reigning oligarchy. In fact, people like Chomsky have pointed out that they actually lead to the breakdown of identities that impede globalization and the globalization specifically of what we call capitalism. I just want to call it oligarchy, right? Mm-hmm. And so we have a left-wing oligarchy. How did we get a left-wing oligarchy? Well, after the Second World War, the left basically realized that organizing the proletariat was something that the right could do very effectively against them, and also that putting dictators in power can certainly turn against them. Stalin was a very scary figure, and so they launched a different path of a new left, if you will, of creating intellectual hegemony. And so this march through the institutions that the old left was already engaged in continued under a new left. And we have now arrived at a point where basically all the dominant values put forward through the media and the popular culture and the educational system and are mirrored in the political realm are all leftist. There's a hegemony of leftist ideas and values. And just as you take a knife to a knife fight and a gun to a gun fight, you take ideas to a battle of ideas. And really, the French New Right is my inspiration here. The French New Right realized that, aside from riots in the streets and student protests and things in the 60s, what the real battle was a battle for cultural hegemony, intellectual hegemony. And so to fight the left in its current manifestation, which is intellectual and cultural hegemony, you have to deconstruct their hegemony with better ideas and create an alternative hegemony. And that's really what the New Right is about, and that's why I call myself a New Rightist. Mm-hmm. And so this is the speech I'm constantly giving in, whenever called upon, to people who think that, we just have to have some kind of Leninist party and then we'll fight a race war. No, it doesn't work that way. If you think that you're going to fight an armed struggle against the the military and police forces of any modern Western society, you're deluded. They can't even beat the mall cops and security guards of any modern Western society. It's just delusional. So anyway, that's where I mainly
differ. So you're saying you have to fight the cultural war, the intellectual war.
It's a cultural and intellectual war, yeah. And that's what the new right is about. That's why I define myself as a new rightist. And what I see the alt-right as is a great front in that cultural and intellectual war. And there are a lot of culture creators involved in this now, very creative people. It's quite exciting. The people creating parody songs, memes, podcasts, videos. It's tremendous, the amount of creativity that's being mobilized. And a lot of these people are very young, again. The guy who's been running my YouTube channel just graduated from high school, right? He just turned 18 this summer. He does very good videos, though, and he's been doing this since he was 13.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's interesting you'd say leftist values. I see what you mean by left identity politics and, you know, things about diversity and things like that. But it's not the left in the sense of working for, you know, the interest of workers, working against income inequality. That's
gone. But you know, the left makes, you know, gestures in that direction, right? Yet in the United States, it's been Democratic administrations, center-left administrations that are completely on board with globalization. That's been massively destructive.
It's not the left anymore. Yeah. It's liberals.
It's, you know, and my attitude is, I wrote a piece called The End of Globalization. I'd recommend it to you. Mm-hmm. I'm working on creating a video for it for YouTube. My values are on most issues leftist. I talk about how globalization is undermining most of the things that progressives hold dear, most of the things that were actually won by the left. And I used to be quite a patriotic American, but as I got to know more about American history, I really came to the conclusion that the most glorious chapter in American history was the history of the labor movement. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not the frontier and not, you know, cobbling together an empire and not constant interventions in, you know, the Latin world and things like that, but the labor movement. I think that but what's happened with globalization is the things that have been fought for, like shorter work weeks, higher pay, making it possible for women not to work in factories. Remember when that was like a leading leftist cause, and children, you know, not working, things like that. All of these things are being undermined, plus environmental regulations as well. And the reason why these things worked, really, is there were limits to trade, right? You were dealing with societies that were not global, but somewhat autarkic. They did engage in trade, but they had mercantilist policies in place and so forth. And when you globalize the marketplace, wages will fall to a global level.
You convinced me of that. A socialist and against free trade and protectionist.
Good. Well, that's we're on the same page then issue.
Isn't that somewhat contradictory with the libertarian trend?
Yes, it is, and libertarianism is. It's contradictory, and what's going on is it's unraveling. Libertarians, of course, believe in globalization and open borders, and you're free to do whatever you want, marry your boa constrictor or whatever. And now they're realizing that there are things more important than trade and individual choice, and that is identity, living in a functioning society, and so forth. And so they basically say this isn't important. It's so interesting to hear people who 3 or 4 years ago were ferocious partisans of free markets now saying None of this is important. None of this matters.
You can see them, so they're just not libertarians anymore.
They're just not libertarians anymore. They would like to live in a society where there's lots of freedom, where it's easy to create a business and stuff like that. But they realize that globalization is actually hollowing that out. And so they want to be libertarians in one country, if you will. They want libertarianism with protectionism. They realize that that's really the only way you can have these things, because libertarianism is an ideological product primarily of homogeneous, high-trust Northern European societies. And it would work in those sorts of societies as long as they maintained certain barriers to entry. For me, I think they're a little too sanguine about that. I mean, I think social democracy works well in those societies too. And this is really the way that some of these former libertarians talk now. It's like, look, it doesn't matter what kind of economic system we have. What matters is that we have a society where it's just us, where we feel like we have a future, and where we can wrangle about women's rights and labor and all these other things amongst ourselves, rather than having different parties basically bringing in alien groups to ally themselves with and use as leverage in their political battles against people who are basically of their own race and nation. For me, I mean, Anglo-Saxon capitalism is a terribly evil system. For me, the Anglo-Saxon capitalist model is the plantation, right? And the globalizing impetus of Anglo-Saxon capitalists in America has been the recreation of plantation economies, basically. Mm-hmm. And the net result of this is also, I think, the social hollowing out of Western countries, and also I think in the increasing destruction of economic and especially technological progress, because there are really two ways of raising productivity. One is you make machines better that allow you to do more, right? The other way of increasing quote-unquote productivity is simply cutting the cost of labor. Right? Yeah. As a mathematical construct, productivity treats those things as equivalent. And yet, as a social phenomenon, those are radically different routes. One has, by restricting labor markets and keeping labor expensive, one of the things that the labor movement has done is constantly pushed for improvement of capital, which makes everybody more productive. Mm-hmm. Once labor markets are opened up and people can increase profitability simply by cutting costs, one of the main impetuses that we've had towards technological progress has been removed. And really, one of the things that was most exciting to me about the recent Republican convention was when Peter Thiel spoke.
Yeah.
And I read his book, Zero to One, and one of the things he maintains is that globalization is incompatible with technological progress, which is really interesting coming from
wow.
Yeah, yeah. This is from a guy who works in Silicon Valley. And he talked about this a bit in that brief speech. He said, you know, all of America used to be high tech. You know, when he was a kid, they were sending men to the moon, right? Today, we have 140 character tweets. You know, most of the technological progress that happens today is in the realm of computers, and most of that is simply improving ways that we can amuse ourselves during our decline. Right. And I think that's very, very powerful. There's a lot of truth to that. I think that in the future, if we get what we want, we're not going to have free trade. We're not going to have globalization. We're not going to have destructive competition that's basically a race to the bottom. And instead, we're going to create conditions where, middle class incomes and working class incomes continually rise, and where there is a constant spur to technological progress that's going to make us all someday out of work. The machines will put us all out of work someday, and then we'll have arrived at utopia.
Talking about libertarians, how does the neo-reaction a movement fit in?
The neo-reaction group is a kind of peculiar group of people. They're kind of snobbish and secretive, but some of them are friendly with me.
Yeah.
and a lot of them come out of libertarianism. A lot of them are in two industries, technology and finance, which I think is why a lot of them are very, very secretive, because they work for huge companies that would frown upon their shenanigans, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a highly interesting, highly intellectual group of people. You know, I read their blogs, I read some of their books, and I value it. They, I think, try to remain aloof. A lot of what they try and do is to remain aloof from actual politics, right? It's sort of an apolitical stance, like you get from like the late Ernst Jünger, or you know, post-war Evola. You know, we'll just rise above all this stuff and not get involved in politics. I think politics is moving in our direction, and not getting involved is not an option at this point. It just makes you irrelevant. Still, they have lots of interesting ideas. One of the things that I most like about the neo-reactionaries is that they've learned a lesson that I learned years ago. For years, the most influential book on me was Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead, most influential piece of fiction, right? Mm-hmm. But that changed, and eventually I realized that the piece of fiction that's had the most influence on my thinking is Frank Herbert's Dune. And the thing that fascinates me about Dune is its combination of futurism with archaic values and social forms, which is basically what Guillaume Fay talks about in his book Archaeofuturism as the way forward. We need to reinfuse modernity with certain things that are treated as archaic. And that means identity politics, an aristocratic ethos, a warrior ethos, and things that have been bred out of us by consumerism and bourgeois modernity and things like that. Mm-hmm. So what Herbert does is basically Herbert applied himself to this question. What social form is consistent with mankind ascending to the stars and colonizing the galaxy? And it was very obvious to him that that was not consistent with democratic politics, which has a very low time horizon, mm-hmm. right? It requires grand politics, grand visions, a grand strategy stretching forward over generations. And we had that briefly sort of under the pressure of the Cold War, and because Kennedy was a visionary, but politics as usual took over. You know, space exploration has faltered and so forth because democracy. And so what you would need to reignite that is you would need some kind of society like we had pre-modernity, where you had aristocracies that fought in dynastic terms, where you had orders like the Catholic Church and things like that, that fought in very long terms over time and perpetuated themselves over time. And what the neo-reactionaries take from Hans Hermann Hoppe in his writings on the failure of democracy is basically this point. Hoppe said, look, democracy is a failure and undermines civilization because it shrinks time horizons down. And that means that you can't pursue grand strategies and civilizational goals. You're just thinking about the next quarter. If you're in business, you're just thinking about the next election if you're a politician. And so the neo-reactionaries take this sort of this critique of democracy and modernity very seriously. And so the question then becomes, what kind of social form do we need basically to get ourselves towards a technological utopia? It's also the same form of on the other hand, however, I've also defended a certain form of populism and a certain form of democracy. I have an essay called Populism, Elitism, and Democracy.
Mm-hmm.
It's in my book New Right versus Old Right. You do need some kind of popular counterbalance to elites. There's no question about it. And I'm a populist in this sense. I believe in sort of classical republicanism as opposed to liberalism. I believe in a kind of organic model of society. I believe, like the classical Republicans believe, that the main force in a society that guards liberty is a strong middle class. However, liberalism and globalization undermine the middle class. Therefore, if you value liberty, you have to value protectionism, and you have to impose certain restrictions on the operation of capitalism to make sure that the rich get richer and the poor get richer and the middle class get richer, right? I don't believe in strict equality, but I do sort of like the Aristotelian idea of inequality has to be somewhat proportionate. There can be distributive justice, in other words, which is a concept that libertarians completely just reject. They write that out of their system of ideas.
So you would still be for keeping a democracy?
Democracy to some extent, but what you have to have is, you have to have, we become too democratic, I think, and that means that given, average people have lower time horizons. The more power that the average people have and the people who ride to power on the votes of average people, the shorter the time horizons are. However, if you just get rid of any kind of popular representation, you're just leaving yourself open to abuse by elites. So the classical Republican view, and this really did influence the founding of America far more than, say, Lockean liberalism, right, which is a myth that libertarians put forward. Classical Republicanism and modern Republicanism a la Montesquieu emphasized the necessity of an organic view of society. You had to have limitations on commerce and things like that. You had to protect the middle class, and you had to have checks and balances. So you had, in effect, the mixed regime. The model of the mixed regime comes from Aristotle's Politics. It's in Montesquieu, and it's in the American Constitution. I think what's happened is, and really every good functional Western European society, ancient and modern, has had some form of a mixed regime. You've had a monarchical principle, whether it's a hereditary, king or a president or whatever. You've had an aristocratic principle, and you've had a popular principle. And those things have to be kept in balance. I sort of believe in the mixed constitution, the mixed order. I just think that we've strayed excessively towards a combination of democracy and oligarchy. And we don't have leaders who think long term about the common good anymore. Again, libertarianism doesn't have a notion of the common good. Right, they've got procedures, and whatever comes out of the sausage machine at the end is blessed, right? No matter what it looks like, because it's going through their procedural notions of right. I now have ex-libertarians who routinely talk about the common good or the good of society. There's a resurgence of these sort of classical Republican notions, like the common good, percolating around within this context of the alt-right, and I'm kind of happy that I'm one of the people who have been promoting that.
Right. Because you would still keep an election, something that does represent the will of the people, because it's one thing having checks and balance, it's another having some way of representing the will of the people.
Yeah, well, the will of the people is a really complicated notion. On the one hand, and this is something I do like to point out against the most anti-democratic people in our circles. The fact of the matter is that if we had direct democracy where people voted with their television set or their smartphone or whatever, or their computer, we would actually have better policies than we do today on things like immigration and trade. There's no question about that. So in situations like that, the people actually know what's right. And better than the elites, which need to be brought into line. They need to be replaced, basically.
Yeah.
What is the will of the people? The people wants what's best for it. But what's best for us is not necessarily what we want at every given moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we really want that cigarette right now, right? But that's not what's best for us in the greater scheme of things. So you do have to give power to the populace, to check elites, but you also have to have people who are wiser and more public-spirited than average in positions mm-hmm. of authority, so they can basically say no. You know, we're not just going to have bread and circuses and free cigarettes and stuff like that. I mean, there are bad popular policies that can come about too through direct democracy. So you do have to have a moderating influence. I mean, this is a standard thing that Rousseau talks about when he talks about the general will. The general will isn't necessarily what the populace wants at any particular moment. It's what they want when they're thinking most rationally about the, you know, things in the long run. And the origin of this idea, fascinatingly enough, is Plato's Gorgias. Socrates in the Gorgias says there's a distinction between what you want and what you think you want right now. What all men want is they want the good life. They want well-being. But what they think they want at any particular moment might not necessarily be conducive to well-being.
Yeah.
And that leads directly to... and if freedom is getting what you really want rather than what you just think you want right now, then that leads directly to Rousseau's conclusion that you can be forced to be free. Right? You can be freer if you are paternalistically prevented from throwing away your freedom and your mm-hmm. future by, say, getting addicted to heroin or something like mm-hmm. that, or gambling away your week's wages before you take it home and to feed your family, stuff like that. So
okay, but and at the end of the day, you'd still be for some form of elections?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Definitely. And there are different ways you can do that. You can do it... I mean, there are forms of representative, popular representation that don't require people like standing for election. You can have sortocracy, right, or where people are... you can have systems like they had in the past where people are randomly pulled
like
out.
Like in Athens.
Yeah, like in Athens, or, you know, like people who do jury service in America today, you're just sort of randomly pulled out to do jury duty. But there are all kinds of ways that you can do that. But yeah, representative democracy is definitely one way to do it. Another way of doing it was plebiscites. Mm-hmm. Plebiscites tend to be quite favored, actually, among sort of authoritarians of the right.
Yeah.
And honestly, if Marine Le Pen ever ends up running France, she's probably going to have to be using plebiscites more than getting things passed through the legislature. So,
yeah. For this, to what extent is the neo-reaction something that influenced the alt-right? Because it's funny, in a lot of the articles that I read in the U.S. media about the alt-right, it seemed to say that neo-reaction was at the core of it.
It's not. It's very peripheral. You see, and this is part of the problem with the news coverage in America.
Yeah.
It's extremely lazy, right? Yeah. They do a quick Google search, and they find a few articles about neo-reaction, and it sounds kind of, okay, I can run with this. It sounds kind of edgy and sinister mm-hmm. even. Yet the fact of the matter is that it has always been marginal, and it holds itself aloof from most of what's going on in the alternative right sphere.
Yeah.
And it has not influenced it all that much. It's influenced me a little bit, or at least it parallels what I think in some ways. I can't say that they've influenced me at all, honestly. But I see where they're coming from. I can complete some of their thoughts. You know, it's simpatico, but it hasn't been influential on the alternative right, and it's just lazy reporting that mm-hmm. leads people to say this kind of stuff, basically.
I mean, I'd say that one of the points in common seems to be the rejection of equality or
equality. The rejection of egalitarianism, a kind of elitism.
There,
you know, but a lot of us are really populist, right? I mean, the core of this thing is a populist attitude.
Yeah.
You might believe that the best way to serve the good of the whole is to have a certain elitist element in government, but you can't even just say that elitism, tout court, right, is completely the way to go. Like I've been arguing, you need a mixed regime. You need a popular element. We are populists, and they are elitists, and that's really the big gap between us. They tend to be really interested in technology and things like that. Well, we're very interested in that, too. There's no question about it. We tend to be engaged in actual things that we hope will produce political change, and they're trying to posture as being above all that. I think basically they're signaling, we're no threat to you, system, that might destroy us or fire us from our job at Google or whatever. We're no threat. We're just harmless little fuzzballs. We're just harmless eccentrics, you know, diddling around on the internet. And I can sort of understand that as a protective coloration or whatever. But a lot of them really do seem to take it seriously. And until they stop that kind of posturing and actually recognize that the world today needs changing and they can actually affect it, they're sort of irrelevant. Interesting, but irrelevant.
Right. I mean, another difference, I would say, tell me if I'm correct, is that if they are strictly anti-modernist, then the alt-right is too modernist in the sense that identitarianism and nationalism are still a product of, you know, the modern times.
One of their memes, I call it the 1789 canard or the, is, you know, they claim that the modern nation state is a very modern invention. You know, yes and no. When you read Machiavelli was calling for what? The unification of the Italians to chase out the barbarians who were invading their country. There was an Italian nation in the Middle Ages, and the Italians recognized each other from, you know, the Piedmont down to Sicily as a common people, divided politically, but a common people. The ancient Greeks regarded themselves as a common people. They were politically divided, but they were the Hellenes as opposed to other people. So there were national identities even in antiquity. There weren't necessarily nation states.
Yeah, nation state is a modern product of modernity.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the great products of modernity. And this is one of the ways where I differ from these people who are like all traditionalists. So if you're a traditionalist, you believe in empire. No.
Yeah.
I'm not a traditionalist in that sense. I don't believe in empire. Empires are always created by murdering people and oppressing them, and I don't believe in that. The people who in our circles who defend empire and colonialism, I always say basically, you know, if you defend these things, you're basically signaling to your neighbors that you're not above a little murder and theft when it suits you.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that. I think that's just a morally retarded attitude, right? It's morally retarded, and it's quite anachronistic because we don't live in a world where white people are ever going to be running everything again.
Yeah.
This is not going to happen, right?
Richard Spencer seems to have a fantasy of recreating a white sort of Roman Empire, Europe and America reunited. It's like a big white empire.
Yeah, well, I think that that's I have an essay called Grandiose Nationalism where I am somewhat critical of that. His views on this have shifted a lot over the last couple of years. A few years ago at American Renaissance, he was calling for the idea of the ethno-state, the ethnically homogeneous homeland. You know, by the beginning of 2014, they gave a talk at the Traditional Britain Group. I forget when that was. I think it was 2013. Why we need Europe, you know, against the Brexit attitudes, or the attitudes that led to the Brexit. After the Ukrainian Revolution, suddenly basically turning Radix into an outlet for Russia Today propaganda and, you know, was extolling empire. And basically, you know, I think a lot of this has to do with the influence of his wife, who's a very, very strident Russian nationalist, and basically spends a lot of her time pushing for, you know, Kremlin propaganda about Ukraine. Suddenly, ethno-nationalism became a bad thing when ethno-nationalism meant Ukraine demanding that it chart its own course rather than let Russia to do it. Mm-hmm. So okay. I think that his thinking on this is sort of overly influenced by political events and by the people he talks to. And it's not... It's not as philosophical or ideological a position as it is something that's sort of news and personal relationship driven.
Mm-hmm. And as for neo-reaction, it seems to me that even though it says it's you know, against anything that's happened since the French Revolution, what it seems to aim for is something that has nothing to do with anything that existed in the past, but more this idea of, you know, the small company units, like dismantling countries in competing companies, basically. I don't know if you've read about that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's something else entirely. It's not. It's neither traditionalist or modernist. It's just, like, geek.
Yeah, it's...
They're corporate.
They're corporate geeks, yeah. Well... Yes, this is a fascinating trait of them. Some of them are traditionalists, others are techno-utopians, others are kind of quasi-libertarians. They're all sort of interacting with one another. The corporation can be a model or can be reconfigured in a kind of quasi-feudal way, I think. I think the Japanese have done this. Mm-hmm. And corporations can implicitly, or in principle, I should say, think very, very long-term, more long-term than politicians. It's just, you know, they're toying with ideas about different social forms that are compatible with long-range thinking. I mean, that's really, I think, the core thing that a lot of the neo-reactionaries are concerned with, is questions about time horizons, and how these things impact civilization and technology and progress.
Hmm. Okay, no, it's good that I'm speaking to you, because I feel like I was a bit misled by some of these articles that seem to put neo-reaction with the alt-right. But, for example, there are points in common, like what the neo-reaction talks about the cathedral, then the alt-right talks about the synagogue. It sounds like it's just the same things.
It is the same thing, but one of the ways that they're doing one thing you have to understand is there's a certain amount of our discourse that's not sincere, and this is the thing that's most troubling to me, because I don't say things just to get, you know, rises out of people. I don't say things for effect. I say things because I think they're true. And I don't believe in propaganda, you know, lying propaganda and stuff like that, or dissimulation, because I just don't think that's not where our strength is, right? Whereas there's this whole troll culture, right, where trolls will say things that are patently false or insincere just to get a rise out of people. And, you know, when people talk about the cathedral, you know, and others talk about the synagogue, it's kind of a trolling thing. It's like, no, it's a synagogue. There, I got you. You know, and but they are opposed to the existing elites, right? There's no question. They do have that in common. The reasons for their opposition, the rationales, the visions of society that they have, they differ somewhat. In the end, they still are fairly marginal to what we call the alt-right, and they kind of want to be. In recent months, or in the last year or two, really, in the last 9 months or so, I've noticed that some people who are friends of mine who are coming out of the NRX sphere are much closer to me, and others have receded behind, you know, a wall of OPSEC, operational security. They've become much more secretive in their interactions, right?
Okay.
You know, some of their little gatherings are open. Some of them are blogging less for the public and writing for one another in their little groups, things like that.
Okay.
So yeah, they're becoming a little more occulted, if you will.
Okay.
Whereas others are being more open.
Right.
One thing that has, I think, excited the whole alternative right, and I think some people in the NRX sphere as well, is the Trump campaign, because he's a populist for one thing, but there are certain dimensions of his thinking and behavior that resonate with some of the NRX concerns with technology, and also some of the NRX attitudes about long-range thinking, because Trump isn't the kind of person who made billions of dollars by like currency gain, currency trades and arbitraging like George Soros. He builds things, and he builds things that last a long, long time.
He
also thinks dynastically. He's got these kids that he's trained to be part of his organization. There's something about him, and he also runs his companies like a feudal baron. He can be very crass, and he sounds like Archie Bunker sometimes. He can be very crass, but by all accounts, in his handling of his employees and the way he relates to them, he's extremely lordly and magnanimous and gentle with people, forgiving, and gives them a lot of latitude. He has some aristocratic virtues about him that are one of the reasons why he's a very effective builder of big companies. So those are some of the things that I think unite us when we look at the Trump phenomenon. We say, there's something here. There's something really exciting here, even though he doesn't really agree with us on a lot of the most important issues.
Just to make sure I understand you, back to my question just before of the differences, of course, you're more populist and they're more
elitist.
But you would both share anti-egalitarianism?
Yes, to some extent. I mean, equality, equality is a nice thing. Okay, but it's not the most important thing. That's
right.
The way I put it. Liberty is a nice thing, but it's not the most important thing.
Right.
There are higher values that might cause us to want to trim liberty of the individual and trim social equality. And to the extent that those higher values exist, I will compromise on those issues. I do think a certain Republican attitude about having a society where there's a broad middle class where people, there are lots of property owners, where people are more self-employed than employed by large corporations, where people don't work on plantations for big bosses and things like that. That is a kind of egalitarian attitude that I have. On the other hand, I don't necessarily think that, and I would love to see an ethos like you have in Japan where where corporate CEOs would be embarrassed to pay themselves as much as Americans do, right, in comparable positions. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see that because they're quite rich anyway, right? There's a certain upper limit. There should be a certain sense of certain classical virtues like temperance, right? I would love to see come back. If people produce more value, they should have more rewards. Income inequality is a fine thing, but you don't want it to translate into social and political inequality, if you put it that way. The breakdown of the functioning of a republic where you've got a lot of free people, self-employed people, and so forth. So I would like to see, say, limits on, well, loan capital, things like that. Mm-hmm. One of the main reasons, and you see this throughout history, and it's been a theme of Republican thinkers throughout history, is if people can borrow against their property,
mm-hmm.
if they can mortgage their property and then lose it, This is one of the ways that independent farmers and homeowners become renters and employees. So you want to find ways of limiting that kind of stuff. Ancient Athens, Solon, one of the things that he instituted was debt repudiation, because he realized that it was threatening the republican liberties of Athens. More and more people were losing their land and becoming laborers on somebody else's land. The plantation economy was asserting itself, right? And so he introduced a shaking off of debts and, broke up estates and gave, small farms to farmers again and tried to recreate the middle class. The same dynamic happened with the destruction of the Romans, the Roman Republic. And in the 19th century American context, the populist movement there was very, very concerned with preventing the impoverishment of farmers. That they were opposed to the gold standard and things like that because they were deflationary and harmed farmers, especially. Yeah. So all of these kinds of issues are things that I would bring back, and those have an egalitarian bite to them. But it's not the idea that totally the complete strict equality is the highest value in society.
Right. I mean, for you, it's identity and order, you could say? Or
identity and order, identity and a kind of organic society. That's what I would like to think of. And organic societies have differentiation in them. They have got hierarchies. But at the same time, there has to be a moral obligation to make all those internal distinctions work for the good of everyone. Yeah. As opposed to this factionalist attitude that, the people on top are ruling for their benefit alone. Which of course.
What does it mean, organic society?
It means organic, like an organism where, today we have an inorganic society where you've got different classes and different groups of people, and they're all pursuing factional interests, right? It's not a single organism, right? With a common life and common interests. It's a zone, an economic zone where warring tribes are fighting over spoils. That's what most societies are like today. Whereas an organic society, there's a sense that it is a whole and it has a common good. There's a whole and there's a common good. If there's not a whole, then there's no common good. And so that's really all I mean by organic. It's a whole, it has a common good, and the internal differentiations that exist in that work towards the common good. And when you start getting a part that's working for its own interests, well, that's analogous to like a tumor growing in a body, right? It's a organ or it's a clump of tissue that's inimical to the common interest. So,
right. And so you think there is a common good for?
Yeah.
The
common good for the French is to keep on being French. It's nothing
more.
That's
your point of view.
Yeah.
Common good.
Yeah.
But what if somebody disagrees that that's the common good?
Well, we can talk it over eventually. But eventually someone's going to decide, and there will be, we hope that we can create the broadest possible consensus, and there will be about 10 or 15% of people who probably never get on board. Mm-hmm. But we can deal with that. In the simplest identitarian sense of a common good, the common good of Hungary is that that Hungarian people will have a home and there will be Hungarian people in the future. That the things that they value and they love will continue to be valued and loved by their descendants, until the sun burns out and we have to go and have Hungary on another planet somewhere. I'm being somewhat facetious, but not 100% facetious. But that's really the attitude that I have. For a European-descended American like myself, the common good really is that the things that we have created and valued first of all, they will be restored, and they will be propagated, and that there's a story of how to put this. You know, I hate using these old 19th century imperialist terms like manifest destiny, but I do think that we should also strive for some kind of destiny to actualize our highest potentialities, and that includes things like perfecting us culturally, perfecting us, perfecting science. One of the things that I think is most important is protecting the biosphere that is massively overstressed. I would like to see human beings continue to explore, you know, the depths of the oceans and outer space, things like that. These things are glorious,
yeah.
Right? And I think that they raise us, you know. Mm-hmm. They elevate us, and we have that potentiality. And I think that when we see these things actualized, we respond with awe because, you know, that's a good thing. That brings us all together.
Right. To what extent is the alt-right a, in part, a revival of the old right before the Reagan and Buckley and, you know, conservative revolution, before basically, you know, National Review republicanism?
Well,
it used to be more isolationist. It used to be more protectionist.
Yeah, and let me just make a little point here. The old right, in the way I use it, people have criticized it. I just stipulated when I wrote this essay, New Right versus Old Right, the old right for me just refers to national socialists and fascists and interwar totalitarian movements. But I did emphasize that there is an old right in the American tradition that's pre-World War II, and yes, they are protectionist. They are anti-interventionist, you know, and yeah, to a great extent, the paleoconservatives were looking back to that old right.
Exactly.
Most definitely. After the Second World War, the right was relaunched by William F. Buckley, and it was really defined in such a way that a lot of what constituted the right before World War II was just thrown out.
Yeah.
You know, nativism, a skepticism towards freedom of trade and things like that. There was a strong right populist critique of liberal economics, libertarian economics in the old right in America. All of that's totally valid. That's one of the things that astonished me in my intellectual journey. Before I became a philosophy major, I was briefly an economics major, and I was very interested in economics. And was somewhat enchanted by the whole free market economics model. And then to discover that there's this whole raft of critiques from the right of liberal, libertarian, free market, Manchesterism, and whatever, economics was a great discovery, because all of that has been completely marginalized, you know, mm-hmm. within the economics profession,
yeah.
Which is very, very interesting, because nominally, a lot of libertarians and free market types are right wing, but the stuff that they really emphasize is completely consistent with, you know, the functioning of our left wing oligarchy, our globalized left wing oligarchy, and the elements of rightist critiques of neoliberalism and liberalism. That they've completely hidden, things like distributism, things like the populist movement, things like the, you know, the critics of gold standards and things like that, or the social credit movement, guild socialism. All of these are incredibly rich traditions of thought, and they have these people absolutely nailed, which I guess is one reason they hide this stuff, because what they stand for doesn't stand up to the kind of critique. And it's very, very interesting. If you go back into the 19th century, when a lot of these movements are coming into existence,
mm-hmm.
You know, there's that the sort of horseshoe effect that people talk about, where the political spectrum curves around and meets in certain ways. And there are a lot of the things that are still valuable about socialism today mm-hmm. were acknowledged and understood for the most part by right-wing critics of capitalism yeah. before the First World War, Second World War, mm. which I think is really interesting.
Yeah. It's always strange for me to hear you say left-wing oligarchs when there's not much I can see that's left-wing, apart from the cultural aspect.
Well, but that's really what it's all been reduced to. It's cultural yeah. Marxism, as people
say. Economy-wise, it's ultra-capitalist, ultra-financialized, globalized, free trade, and I mean, all these things are for what I would call right-wing, in the sense of pro-market, pro-capitalist.
Right, right. Yeah, but I think you do understand my point, though. I mean, I would agree that it's bad for the public, it's bad for working people, the middle class, and it's bad for society as a whole, and yet there are lots and lots of leftists who are perfectly comfortable with this system and the sort of left-wing identity politics, yeah. especially as it exists as identity politics, is organically part of this oligarchy yeah. today.
Exactly, but I don't consider them legitimate left.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
But yeah, I see what you mean. I see you.
Self-described leftists, then, who are organically part of the oligarchy.
Yeah, I get it. Okay, let me see if I think I've asked practically all of my questions. So just out of curiosity, you majored in philosophy. That's what you told me.
Yes.
And is that a master's in philosophy?
I got a PhD. Yeah.
Oh, you have a PhD.
A bachelor's, a master's, and a PhD in philosophy.
Oh, okay. What university?
I don't want to go into all these particulars.
Oh, you don't want to say anything at all?
But. Yeah. I mean, there are 53,000 Greg Johnsons on Facebook alone.
Oh.
So that provides me with a certain cloud of unknowing that I can hide details in.
Because...
Yeah.
You don't hide your political opinions in your everyday life?
No, but I don't want people throwing bricks through my windows and things like
oh,
that.
Oh, right, of course.
So, or... Theresa May, or I guess she's now the Prime Minister, but I don't want the Home Office sending me letters banning me from the United Kingdom, which I know they would do if they could just figure out which of those 50-some thousand Greg Johnsons on Facebook I am and send something to my address, but, you know. So, then, yeah, I'm trying to...
Do you still work in academia? I mean, are you a researcher, teacher? No.
No, okay. My academic career was brief and inglorious. And uh-huh. I went directly from there into being involved in all this stuff. So I...
You mean professionally? This
is my job. I make a living as a publisher blogger.
Okay.
Yeah, on the New Right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I employ myself and a couple other people, actually, with my efforts.
Okay. Okay, this, I should have asked this question from the very beginning, but sorry, it's sort of all over the place. The alt-right, you could say that it starts around 2010. Would that be a date where, because the thing is that so many older trends and older movements that seem to come together, it's hard to put a beginning date.
I think between 2008 and 2009 was probably when it was coming together as an idea, and then in 2010, at the beginning of the year, the webzine Alt-Right was launched. So I guess it was coming together in 2008, 2009, and then it sort of rolled out to the world at the beginning of 2010.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks a lot for taking all that time to develop all these points. It was very helpful.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed this, actually. This was fun. And,
you must interviewed a lot, no?
No, actually not. I've been dodging interviews with the American press for a couple of reasons. One, the main reason, is that I kind of want Donald Trump to win. And American reporters have been contacting me, basically, because they're trying to get juicy quotes to smear him with by associating him with all kinds of crazy unappetizing radicals like me, and I don't want to play their little game. Mm-hmm. I figured you being in France, you're far enough away from that particular low agenda.
This is the U.S.
Yeah. So anyway, I figured why not, you know. So, yeah.
It's
so
not even web-based. It's an actual paper publication, so you can't even go online.
Yeah, I tried to do a little research about you, and it's like, wait, this is ink and paper. How archaic, you know. But that's great. I actually like that fact. And when the lights all go out, it'll still be around. So in printed form. So I made a reference recording of this. Would you mind after your article comes out or whatever if I were to make that public?
Our interview?
Yeah. I thought it was very interesting.
I definitely do not want to be filmed.
I just have the audio.
Huh. Well, I'll have to think about it. I mean, I didn't really contradict you at all because it wasn't really a debate.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose, I'm not sure I would want my name associated. Well, I mean, I'm not going to hide that I interviewed you because I'm going to be using the interview, but, I suppose there's nothing, there's nothing wrong with it, I guess.
Right. Well, I can send you the recording if you wanted to listen to it over again.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Sure. I would have paid more attention to being, a bit more articulate in my questions.
Oh, no, you were excellent. You were quite good. I was really happy. I was feeling like I was searching and mumbling and wool gathering a lot.
Fair enough.
So.
No, but you, yeah, I mean, I suppose, I guess there's nothing wrong with it. I just wouldn't want to, my face to appear.
No, not at all. It's just an audio.
Because the crowd looks kind of aggressive.
Of course, yeah.
So I don't know if I'd want to be, attacked, but,
No one's going to do that. But, no, seriously, well.
Okay, no, but
think about it. Yeah.
That should be okay. And, okay, well, yeah, thanks a lot for taking all that time.
No, it was a pleasure. And just send me a link to whatever you write up. I'd like to see it. So,
okay. It probably won't be online, but...
Oh, okay. Could you send me a copy of it then?
Maybe I can make a PDF.
PDF, yeah.
It'll be a very, very long, long article.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, good. I read French pretty well, so I will enjoy
it. It probably, as you can guess from my honest presentation of myself, it will not be favorable, but it will be, as you can guess.
I can't ask everyone to agree with me, but I do enjoy having civil intellectual conversations and debates. So.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is it should be possible to talk with even your adversaries. But what's also troubling and interesting is that of course, I'm not sensitive at all to the race and identity. It doesn't talk to me at all. But on the other hand, the whole, I don't know, the critique of globalization and that part of it is totally compatible with my politics. So that's always sort of troubling to see what the points in common.
Yeah, well, it is interesting to me. I used to be a libertarian, and all of this stuff fell on deaf ears. And now I sort of think of myself as left-wing as one can reasonably be.
Mm-hmm.
And yet at the same time, I think that if you – my essay, The End of Globalization, the main point that I make is that if you're going to draw a line and halt globalization, what's the natural line to draw it at? What is the natural end point? And I say that it's natural to draw the line at the nation state.
Mm-hmm.
It's natural, and it also, it just makes sense because that's how you've got governments in place, you've got common history, you've got policies, a lot of things that were very good that have happened over the last century happened within the context of nations that had protectionist measures in place. And so in some ways, to end globalization, you need to restore, you need to reset to an earlier form of what France was up to, or the United States was up to.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. The thing is, then the discussion is, how do you make a nation? Is it based on an idea of citizenship, or is it based on an idea of ethnicity? And that's probably where we sort of diverge.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the mainstream today is, at best, civic nationalism. Even the Front National is a civic nationalist organization. Donald Trump is a civic nationalist. There's no question about it. Yeah. I think that I would like to go to a civic nationalism. I think that would be an improvement. However, I think that it's an inherently unstable form of government, and that there are fault lines, ethnic fault lines within any civic nationalist thing that would have to be addressed next. And so it just so happens that societies where civic nationalism is always trying to foist artificial forms of unity upon people. And why should we foist artificial forms of unity upon people when there are actual organic forms of unity that are already there? Even probably in you, because, you know, you're French, you know, you have a lot in common with other French people, and there's an organic connectedness that you have, that is probably more rooted and more stable and more, therefore, conducive to a functioning just society than artificial civic forms of nationalism that we're constantly trying to impose. And here's another thing. You know, Carl Schmitt is wonderful about this. You know, he talks about how to function, democracy is illiberal. You know, democracy and liberalism don't go together, because when a democracy is trying to function, it tries to impose unity on the populace. And if it's a multicultural or multi-ethnic populace, it will impose forms of unity, often fake. I mean, and one of the most interesting things is to look at the history of say, 20th century fake nationalisms like Turkish nationalism, for instance. They invented a whole fake history for themselves. It's really quite remarkable.
All nations fake that. Yeah. All nations fake invented.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and but it has to be imposed at a certain violence on groups that don't.
For sure.
Yeah, and of course, what happened, in the Ottoman Empire when they tried to create Turkishness as a unifying factor is they basically tried to exterminate the Christian minorities of the empire. I mean, it was there is a terrible logic to this. Which is why I favor, if necessary, breaking up these nation states if they're mini empires, so that you don't have to have fake forms of unity imposed, really by doing violence to people's identity.
Yeah, I think I'm more skeptical about being able to achieve that unity, even through. I mean, just because maybe I believe as a Marxist, I probably believe too much in class antagonism, mm-hmm. and I don't feel close at all to the French boss exploiting people. You know,
right?
I feel that. That's just my Marxist approach, probably.
Well, you know, I'm not a Marxist, obviously.
I'm glad we got that.
Yeah, we got that out there, yeah, in case you were wondering about that. Really, I there are all kinds of things that Marxists are zeroing in on that are bad, right, about capitalism and modernity. But I just don't think that the Marxist framework is true or adequate. I don't believe in historical materialism. I'm really a kind of historical idealist. I think, honestly, as a political philosophy and as an account of history, Hegel is disturbingly close to the truth for me. Mm-hmm. and the great thing about Hegel, I think, is he rediscovers something that's central to classical political philosophy, which is the concept of thumos, the middle part of the soul, the spirited mm-hmm. part of the soul, that is. What? It's attached to one's own, including one's own identity, ultimately. Mm-hmm. Not just one's personal identity, one's sense of honor, but also one's place, one's roots, one's homeland, one's people. That was, for all the classical Greek thinkers, the essentially political emotion, right? Mm-hmm. Desire, well, that leads to the global marketplace. Reason, that leads to the cosmopolis, the republic of letters, right? Mm-hmm. But the distinctly political part of the soul that leads to diversity of political orders is thumos. And, you know, Hegel believes that really it's thumos that's the driving force of history. The master-slave dialectic is all about what's a struggle to the death over honor, which is the thumotic part of the soul. And one of the things that I've been working on just recently is a review of Peter Sloterdijk's book, Rage and Time. Yeah. Because I found out that actually one of the thinkers, one of the strategists for Alternative für Deutschland is a student of his, and in Rage and Time, Sloterdijk is arguing for the inadequacy of modern liberalism, and I would also say Marxism too, and psychoanalysis to understand the distinctly political emotions and passions which are connected with thumos. And this fellow whose name escapes me now, the Sloterdijk student, basically has come up with an argument for German nationalism that's very, very simple and bypasses all the events from 1933 to 1945. He simply says, look, it's natural, normal, and right for people to love their own, to have a love of one's own. A preference for people who are closer to them over strangers. And that's really the basis for ethnic nationalism. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very powerful argument, actually. And so if you look at Carl Schmitt's The Concept of the Political, what, you know, really the sort of hidden assumption there is the power of thumos, right? Because he says there will never be a global polity, right?
Yeah.
Politics is always plural for him. Well, what does that mean? It means that there's something, everything inherent in the political is a particularizing force that always will posit an us versus a them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, I think, is a dimension that, for me, really opened up the book of history. I don't think that people really understand history by looking back at it through materialist lenses. Yeah. I think that most of the cultural realm is based on an economy of, if you will, thumos rather than desire. It's an economy of creating. Human beings are articulating their distinctness as a species. By creating artificial worlds that are not governed by the economy of desire. And so I look at someone like Bataille in his sort of Nietzsche-influenced writings about culture as having something essential that he's saying that fits in with the sort of Hegelian and Platonic notion of thumos, because we create culture precisely by negating materialism, mm-hmm. right? We raise ourselves above the realm of necessity by creating luxury. And so I think that history has to be understood not through materialism, but primarily as a negation of materialism, mm-hmm. which creates this realm of culture. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm not a historical materialist.
Yeah. would you mind sending me the recordings?
Write
down everything. It'll be easier to.
Yeah, of course. And I just hope that my Skype recorder automatically popped on like it's supposed to. But yeah. So thank you so much. I do have to run. I have to take my dog out. There's some construction going on next door. I don't know what's going on. I hope it I hope it hasn't been too distracting to you, but I hear these machines.
Oh, I didn't hear it at all.
Oh, good, good. These machines have been crashing away. Okay, well, thank you so much, and
well, thank you.
We'll be in touch.